Elizabeth Bishop. She was born in 1911 in Worcester, Massachusetts. Her parents are middle class. Her father, William Thomas Bishop, died 8 months later, and her mother, Gertrude, never recovered and went into a mental home when Elizabeth was four. Elizabeth never saw her again, although her mother didn't die for another 20 years. It was to be the first of many great losses.
One art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, a disaster.
In a letter to Robert Lowell, she said,
"When you write my epitaph, you must say I was the loneliest person who ever lived."
She was effectively an orphan. She was raised by her grandparents, particularly by her maternal grandmother, in Worcester, Massachusetts. The next poem, Manners, speaks of the influence of her grandfather.
My grandfather said to me, as we sat on the wagon seat, "Be sure to remember to always speak to everyone you meet." We met a stranger on foot. My grandfather's whip tapped his hat. "Good day, sir, good day, a fine day," and I said it and bowed where I sat. Then we overtook a boy we knew with his big pet crow on his shoulder. "Always offer everyone a ride. Don't forget that when you get older," my grandfather said. So Willie climbed up with us, but the crow gave a caw and flew off. I was worried. How would he know where to go? But he flew a little way at a time, from fence post to fence post ahead. And when Willie whistled, he answered, "A fine bird," my grandfather said. "And he's well brought up. See, he answers nicely when he's spoken to. Man or beast, that's good manners. Be sure that you both always do." When automobiles went by, the dust hid the people's faces, but we shouted, "Good day, good day, fine day," at the top of our voices. When we came to Hustler Hill, he said that the mayor was tired, so we all got down and walked, as our good manners required.
Elizabeth was always clever, and she got into Vassar to read English. Her best friend there, Louise Crane, became her first love, although she always disliked the word lesbian. She met Marianne Moore the year that she graduated in 1934.
But this poem is for Louise Crane.
Sorry.
It's called Letter to New York, for Louise Crane. In your next letter, I wish you'd say where you are going and what you are doing. How are the plays, and after the plays, what other pleasures you are pursuing? Taking cabs in the middle of the night, driving as if to save your soul, where the road goes round and round the park and the meter glares like a moral owl. And the trees look so queer and green, standing alone in big black caves. And suddenly you're in a different place where everything seems to happen in waves. And most of the jokes you just can't catch, like dirty words rubbed off a slate. And the songs are loud but somehow dim, and it gets so terribly late. And coming out of the brownstone house to the grey sidewalk the watered street. One side of the buildings rises with the sun like a glistening field of wheat. Wheat, not oats, dear. I'm afraid if it's wheat, it's none of your sowing. Nevertheless, I'd like to know what you are doing and where you are going.
Now she met Marianne Moore the year that she graduated in 1934.
Can we just make a little quick check that everybody can hear at the back? Is it okay? Yes. Any problems?
Any
so I just have that now rather than at
thank
the end.
Thank you very much indeed. I was too quiet earlier today. I learned my lesson. Right, Marianne Moore, 1934.
Invitation to Miss Marianne Moore. From Brooklyn, over the Brooklyn Bridge, on this fine morning, please come flying. In a cloud of fiery, pale chemicals, please come flying. To the rapid rolling of thousands of small blue drums descending out of the mackerel sky over the glittering grandstand of harbour water, please come flying. Come with the pointed toe of each black shoe trailing a sapphire highlight, with a black capeful of butterfly wings and bon mots, with heaven knows how many angels all riding on the broad black brim of your hat, please come flying. Bearing a musical, inaudible abacus, a slight censorious frown and blue ribbons, please come flying. Facts and skyscrapers glint in the tide. Manhattan is all awash with morals this fine morning, so please come flying. For whom the grim museums will behave like courteous male bowerbirds, for whom the agreeable lions lie in wait on the steps of the public library, eager to rise and follow through the doors up into the reading rooms, please come flying. We can sit down and weep. We can go shopping, or play at a game of constantly being wrong with a priceless set of vocabularies. Or we can bravely deplore, but please, please come flying. Come like a light in the white mackerel sky. Come like a daytime comet, with a long, unnebulous train of words. From Brooklyn, over the Brooklyn Bridge, on this fine morning, please come flying.
Her first poems were published in an anthology entitled New Writing, which Marianne Moore edited.
I never left Cumberland Street, where Marianne lived, without feeling happier, uplifted, even inspired.
Elizabeth and Louise jointly bought a house in Key West. They both loved fishing, and although their affair ended before the war, they remained friends. And Elizabeth stayed in Key West for 9 years. She began to publish in The New Yorker and other magazines, and in 1945, her first collection, North and South, was published to great acclaim. The poet Randall Jarrett wrote, "The best poems in Elizabeth Gresham's North and South are so good that it takes a geological event to overshadow them. The fish and roosters are two of the most calmly beautiful, deeply sympathetic poems of our time."
The fish. I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat, half out of water, with my hook fast in a corner of his mouth. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung a grunting weight, battered and venerable and homely. Here and there his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper, and its pattern of darker brown was like wallpaper, shapes like full-blown roses, stained and lost through age. He was speckled with barnacles, fine rosettes of lime, and infested with tiny white sea lice. And underneath, two or three rags of green weed hung down, while his gills were breathing in the terrible oxygen, the frightening gills, fresh and crisp with blood, that can cut so badly. I thought of the coarse white flesh, packed in like feathers, the big bones and the little bones, the dramatic reds and blacks of his shiny entrails, and the pink swim bladder like a big peony. I looked into his eyes, which were far larger than mine, but shallower and yellowed, the irises hacked and packed with tarnished tin foil, seen through the lenses of old scratched isinglass. They shifted a little, but not to return my stare. It was more like the tipping of an object toward the light. I admired his sullen face, the mechanism of his jaw, and then I saw that from his lower lip, if you could call it a lip, grim, wet, and weapon-like, hung five old pieces of fish line, or four and a wire leader with a swivel still attached, with all their five big hooks grown firmly in his mouth. A green line frayed at the end where he broke it, two heavier lines and a fine black thread still crimped from the strain and snap when it broke and he got away. Like medals with their ribbons, frayed and wavering, a five-haired beard of wisdom trailing from his aching jaw. I stared and stared, and victory filled up the little rented boat from the pool of bilge where oil had spread a rainbow around the rusted engine, to the baler, rusted orange, the sun-cracked thwarts, the oarlocks on their strings, the gunwales, until everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. And I let the fish go.
Randall Jarrett went on to write about her. You don't need to be told that the poetry of Marianne Moore was, in the beginning, an appropriately selected foundation for Miss Bishop's work. All her poems have written underneath, "I have seen it." The poet Robert Lowell also reviewed her collection. The splendour and minuteness of her descriptions soon seems wonderful. Later, one realises that her large, controlled and elaborate common sense is always, or almost always, absorbed in its subject, and she is the one of the best craftsmen alive. It was the start of a friendship which lasted for the rest of her life. They wrote to one another almost every week for the rest of their lives. They were in what they were writing, or what they were reading, and who they saw. Lowell was handsome, patrician, learned, and already a star poet. Elizabeth describes their meeting in Words in Air, the volume of their correspondence, which was subsequently published, running to nearly 800 pages.
Lowell arrived, and I loved him at first sight. He was living in a basement room on Third Avenue, I think, at the time, and was rather untidy. He was wearing a rumpled dark blue suit. I remember the sad state of his shoes. He needed a haircut, and he was very handsome. Handsome in an almost old-fashioned, poetic way. I took to him at once. I didn't feel the least bit afraid.
Elizabeth was also a more than decent composer and musician. She studied music at college and was a pupil of Ralph Kirkpatrick, the noted harpsichordist. And she was, particularly importantly, a very talented painter, especially of watercolours. Indeed, she wrote like a painter and painted like a writer, or usually on small pieces of A4 paper, though she was dismissive.
From time to time, I paint a small gouache or watercolour and give them to friends.
Though she added firmly,
"They are not art. Not at all."
So there. Nevertheless, later, after her death in 1993, William Benton put together an exhibition of more than 25 of her paintings in the East Martello Tower Museum in Key West and published a book catalogue about them, Exchanging Hats. As she wrote in an indirect metaphor about switching forms in a 1956 poem with the same title, Exchanging Hats,
"Unfunny uncles who insist in trying on a lady's hat. Oh, even if the joke falls flat, we share your slight transvestite twist." In spite of our embarrassment, costume and custom are complex. The headgear of the other sex inspires us to experiment.
The painting was important to her. She loved Paul Klee, Villa, and she actually bought a Carl Schwitter, rather surprisingly, who Elizabeth called modest artists. Like a painter, her poems are full of concentrated observations of birds, of animals, of flora and fauna, of children.
At the fish houses. Although it is a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming, almost invisible, a dark purple-brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish, it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs, and narrow cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver. The heavy surface of the sea, swelling slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque. But the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and masts scattered among the wild, jagged rocks, is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in the sparse, bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked, with two long bleached handles and some melancholy stains like dried blood, where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the grey stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I have seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music, like me, a believer in total immersion. So I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang, "A mighty fortress is our God." He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge, almost in the same spot, with a sort of shrug, as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, grey, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand, waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded grey and blue-grey stones. I have seen it over and over, the same sea, the same slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark grey flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be. Dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free. drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts, forever flowing and drawn, and since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown.
North and South, her first collection and published in 1946, also includes poems drawn from her life, including, rather surprisingly, a poem about the singer Billie Holiday, who became a friend of hers. And like a painter, returning to a canvas and adding a mark here and adjusting a tone there, she would return again and again to a poem. Her poem, The Moose, took 16 years to complete, she having promised to dedicate it to her Aunt Grace in 1956, but didn't finish it until 1972. Robert Lowell, in his poem for Elizabeth Bishop, wrote,
"You still hang your words in air, 10 years unfinished, glued to your notice board with gaps or empties for the unimaginable phrase. Unerring muse, who makes the casual perfect."
She received the Houghton Mifflin Fellowship Award for North and South, and in 1951, Bryn Mawr awarded her a fellowship to travel. She planned to circumnavigate South America, but her ship took 17 days just to reach the Brazilian port of Santos, arriving in November 1951. She was completely enchanted.
Arrival at Santos. Here is a coast. Here is a harbour. Here, after a meagre diet of horizon, is some scenery. Impractically shaped, and who knows, self-pitying mountains, sad and harsh beneath their frivolous greenery, with a little church on top of one. And warehouses, some of them painted a feeble pink or blue, and some tall, uncertain palms. Oh, tourist, is this how this country is going to answer you and your immodest demands for a different world? And a better life? And complete comprehension of both at last and immediately after 18 days of suspension? Finish your breakfast. The tender is coming. A strange and ancient craft, flying a strange and brilliant rag. So that's the flag. I never saw it before. I somehow never thought of there being a flag. But of course there was all along. And coins, I presume, and paper money, they remain to be seen. And gingerly now we climb down the ladder backward. Myself and a fellow passenger named Miss Breen, descending into the midst of 26 freighters, waiting to be loaded with green coffee beans. "Please, boy, do be more careful with that boat hook. Watch out! Oh, it's caught Miss Breen's skirt! There, Miss Breen is about 70, a retired police lieutenant, after all, 6 feet tall, with beautiful bright blue eyes and a kind expression. Her home, when she is at home, is in Glens Falls, New York. There, we are settled. The customs officials will speak English, we hope, and leave us our bourbon and cigarettes. Ports are necessities, like postage stamps or soap. But they seldom seem to care what impression they make, or, like this, only attempt, since it does not matter, the unassertive colours of soap or postage stamps, wasting away like the former, slipping the way the latter do when we mail the letters we wrote on the boat, either because the glue here is very inferior, or because of the heat. We leave Santos at once. We are driving to the interior.
Elizabeth travelled by train to Rio. She expected to resume her voyage after 2 weeks, and she was put up in the Copacabana penthouse apartment by a friend of a friend, Lota de Macedo Suarez. But Elizabeth fell ill, and she had an allergic reaction to a cashew nut. And she, I'm serious, she lost her sight for a week. Lotta nursed her, and they fell in love. Lotta was a year older than Elizabeth, small, dynamic, clever, bespectacled, volatile, outward-going. "Do not underestimate Lotta," said one friend. She spoke fluent French and fractured English and was very well-read. Elizabeth, per contra, was small, dumpy, with a round face and graying hair, and shy. But people loved her and always wanted throughout her life to look after her. Indeed, Lowell thought seriously about asking her to marry him. Both Elizabeth and Lothar loved sports cars, rather surprisingly. Lothar had an MG Roadster and then a Jaguar, and though she loved those sports cars, Elizabeth preferred to drive no more than 30 miles an hour. The poet Anne Stevenson, who got to know Elizabeth in the 1960s, said Elizabeth was always shy and, in a dignified way, modest. Art for her was crystalline, a possibility for purity. That was why she didn't sully it with excretions from her own life. Elizabeth and Lothar started to live together, soon moving to the modern house that Lothar was building in the mountains above Petropolis, an hour's drive from Rio. Lothar acted the mother, Elizabeth the child.
It was the first time anyone ever offered me a home, or so much. Lothar's gesture meant just everything. Sometimes it seems as though only intelligent people are stupid enough to fall in love, and only stupid people are intelligent enough to let themselves be loved.
Brazil was a complete revelation. Questions of travel.
There are too many waterfalls here. The crowded streams hurry too rapidly down to the sea. And the pressure of so many clouds on the mountaintops makes them spill over the sides in soft, slow motion, turning to waterfalls under our very eyes. For if those streaks, those mile-long, shiny tear stains aren't waterfalls yet, in a quick age or so, as ages go here, they probably will be. But if the streams and clouds keep traveling, the mountains look like the hulls of capsized ships, slime-hung and barnacled. Think of the long trip home. Should we have stayed at home and thought of here? Where should we be today? Is it right to be watching strangers in a play in this strangest of theatres? What childishness is it that while there's a breath of life in our bodies, we are determined to rush to see the sun the other way around? The tiniest green hummingbird in the world. To stare at some inexplicable old stonework, inexplicable and impenetrable, at any view, instantly seen and always, always delightful. Oh, must we dream our dreams and have them, too? And have we room for one more folded sunset, still quite warm? But surely it would have been a pity not to have seen the trees along this road, really exaggerated in their beauty, not to have seen them gesturing like noble pantomimists robed in pink, not to have had to stop for gas and heard the sad two-noted wooden tune of disparate wooden clogs carelessly clacking over a grease-stained filling station floor. In another country, the clogs would all be tested. Each pair there would have had identical pitch. A pity not to have heard the other less primitive music of the fat brown bird who sings above the broken gasoline pump in a bamboo church of Jesuit baroque. Three towers, five silver crosses. Yes, a pity not to have pondered, blurredly and inconclusively, on what connection can exist for centuries between the crudest wooden footwear and, careful and finicky, the whittled fantasies of wooden cages. Never to have studied history in the weak calligraphy of songbirds' cages, and never to have had to listen to rain, so much like politicians' speeches, 2 hours of unrelenting oratory, and then a sudden golden silence, in which the traveller takes a notebook, writes, "Is it lack of imagination that makes us come to imagined places, not just stay at home? Or could Pascal have been not entirely right about just sitting quietly in one's room? Continent, city, country, society. The choice is never wide and never free. and here or there. No. Should we have stayed at home? Wherever that may be?
It is a rarity, an autobiographical poem that she dedicated to Lota with the words of the 16th century Portuguese poet Luís de Camões.
Oh, to give you as much as I can, since the more I give you, the more I owe you.
Lota's house was at the top of Samambaia, designed by an architect called Sergio Bernardes, who was a pupil of Walter Gropius. He designed it in glass and steel with a wall of granite at its back. Lota designed Elizabeth a special studio in the garden for her to write in, facing away from the amazing view. Brazil filled her poems, as did its magnificent wildlife.
Sandpiper. The roaring alongside he takes for granted, and that every so often the world is bound to shake. He runs to the south, finical, awkward, in a state of controlled panic, a student of Blake. The beach hisses like fat. On his left, a sheet of interrupting water comes and goes and glazes over his dark and brittle feet. He runs straight through it, watching his toes. Watching, rather, the spaces of sand between them, where, no detail too small, the Atlantic drains rapidly backwards and downwards. As he runs, he stares at the dragging grains. The world is a mist, and then the world is minute and vast and clear. The tide is higher or lower, he couldn't tell you which. His beak is focused, he is preoccupied. Looking for something, something, something. Poor bird, he is obsessed. The millions of grains are black, white, tan and grey, mixed with quartz grains, rose and amethyst.
As did their house fill her work. Song for a rainy season.
Song for the rainy season. Hidden, oh, hidden in the high fog, the house we live in, beneath the magnetic rock, rain, rainbow-ridden, where blood black bromelias, lichens, owls, and the lint of the waterfalls cling, familiar, unbidden. In a dim age of water, the brook sings loud from a rib cage of giant fern. Vapor climbs up the thick growth effortlessly, turns back, holding them both, house and rock, in a private cloud. At night, on the roof, blind drops crawl, and the ordinary brown owl gives us proof he can count. Five times, always five, he stamps and takes off after the fat frogs that, shrilling for love, clamber and mount. House, open house to the white dew and the milk-white sunrise, kind to the eyes, to membership of silverfish, mouse, bookworms, big moths, with a wall for the mildew's ignorant map. Darkened and tarnished by the warm touch of the warm breath, maculate, cherished. Rejoice, for a later era will differ. Oh, difference that kills or intimidates much of all our small, shadowy life. Without water, the great rock will stare, unmagnetized, bare, no longer wearing rainbows or rain. The forgiving air and the high fog gone, the owls will move on, and the several waterfalls shrivel in the steady sun.
Elizabeth and Lota were very happy. Indeed, she described these for Elizabeth. They were
the happiest years of her life.
They had a good circle of friends who came to Samambaia to swim in their pool and eat figs and prosciutto. Lota's old friend, Carlos Lacerda, ran for governor of the state, of which Rio was the capital, and won. He commissioned Lothar to design a people's park called Flamingo Park on Guanabara Bay, along the coast from Rio on landfill, on the northern edge of Botafogo Bay, opposite Sugarloaf Mountain. Although Lothar had no qualifications whatsoever or experience, it was a huge project with as big as Central Park in New York, with cafes, restaurants, carousels, football pitches, museums, libraries, a dance pavilion, a boat pond, and beaches. Not unambitious. It took several years and opened to considerable acclaim, but it ran into inevitable political problems, and Lothar and the male bureaucrats, unused to taking orders from a woman, fell out while her relations with Lacerda soured. Even the landscape designer Lothar appointed turned on her. The park consumed Lothar, and Elizabeth came to hate it.
I am utterly sick of Brazilian politics, big and little.
Elizabeth wrote to Lowell. She accepted work as a poet in residence back in the United States, and while she was there, she began an affair with someone called Suzanne Bowen, a divorcee in her early 20s, who had a son. Meanwhile, the park opened, but Lothar's health declined. She was diagnosed with arteriosclerosis, or words to that effect, and suffered a nervous breakdown. She also found out about Elizabeth's affair. Elizabeth began to drink more heavily. She had always been a binge drinker, drinking anything, even eau de cologne when alcohol wasn't available. Now, Lothar's psychiatrist advised Elizabeth to get away temporarily. She returned to New York. Both she and Lothar made new wills. Later, Elizabeth read Lothar's, which indicated that she had always been planning suicide. She quoted Voltaire.
If God exists, he will forgive me. That's his business.
Lothar flew to New York. Elizabeth met her and thought she looked very sick and depressed. They had a friendly, happy meal, and Lothar went to bed, having taken, without Elizabeth realizing it, a whole bottle of Valium. She went into a coma, which she remained in for a week before her heart failed. Elizabeth wrote,
"She was a wonderful, remarkable woman. I had 12 or 13 of the happiest years of my life with her before she got sick. And I suppose that is a great deal in this unmerciful world."
Lothar's relatives and friends in Rio blamed Elizabeth, and it became impossible for her to continue to live in her house in Oro Preto. She moved back to the States, to California, and she never returned to Brazil.
Am I reading Brazil now?
Aye. Be a nice place to read Brazil.
Brazil, January the 1st. January's. Nature greets our eyes exactly as she must have greeted theirs. Every square inch filling in with foliage, big leaves, little leaves, and giant leaves, blue, blue-green, and olive, with occasional lighter veins and edges, or a satin underleaf turned over. Monster ferns in silver-grey relief, and flowers, too, like giant water lilies up in the air, up rather in the leaves, purple, yellow, two yellows, pink, rust-red and greenish-white, solid but airy, fresh as if just finished and taken off the frame. A blue-white sky, a simple web, backing for feathery detail. Brief arcs, a pale green broken wheel, a few palms, swarthy, squat but delicate, and perching there in profile, beaks agape. The big symbolic birds keep quiet, each showing only half his puffed and padded, pure-coloured or spotted breast. Still in the foreground, there is sin. Five sooty dragons near some massy rocks. The rocks are worked with lichens, grey moonbursts splattered and overlapping, threatened from underneath by moss in lovely hell-green flames, attacked above by scaling ladder vines, oblique and neat, one leaf yes and one leaf no, in Portuguese. The lizards scarcely breathe. All eyes are on the smaller, female one, back too, her wicked tail straight up and over, red as a red-hot wire. Just so the Christians, hard as nails, tiny as nails, and glinting in creaking armour, came and found it all. Not unfamiliar. No lovers' walks, no bowers, no cherries to be picked, no lute music, but corresponding nevertheless to an old dream of wealth and luxury, already out of style when they left home. Wealth plus a brand new pleasure. Directly after Mass, humming perhaps L'Homme Armé or some such tune, they ripped away into the hanging fabric, each out to catch an Indian for himself. Those maddening little women who kept calling, calling to each other, or had the birds waked up and retreating, always retreating behind it.
Elizabeth was by now a very well-known and celebrated poet, despite her small output. Her Complete Poems was awarded the National Book Award for Poetry to add to the Pulitzer Prize she won in 1956. Indeed, her reputation now had outstripped that of Lowell. She started a new relationship with Alice Methfessel, much younger than she was, who she'd met at Harvard when she took over Lowell's courses, and to whom she dedicated her last book, Geography 3. Her poems started to become elegiac. Santarém,
looking back on her life in Brazil. Of course, I may be remembering it all wrong after how many years? That golden evening, I really wanted to go no farther. More than anything else, I wanted to stay a while in that conflux of two great rivers, Tapajos, Amazon, grandly, silently flowing, flowing east. Suddenly there'd been houses, people, and lots of mongrel riverboats skittering back and forth under a sky of gorgeous, underlit clouds, with everything gilded, burnished along one side, and everything bright, cheerful, casual, or so it looked. I liked the place. I liked the idea of the place. Two rivers. Hadn't two rivers sprung from the Garden of Eden? No, that was four, and they diverged. Here, only two, and coming together. Even if one were tempted to literary interpretations such as life, death, right, wrong, male, female, such notions would have resolved, dissolved straight off in that watery, dazzling dialectic. Two rivers full of crazy shipping, people all apparently changing their minds, embarking, disembarking, rowing clumsy dories. After the Civil War, some southern families came here. Here they could still own slaves. They left occasional blue eyes, English names, and oars. No other place, no one on all the Amazon's 4,000 miles does anything but paddle. A dozen or so nuns, white-habited, waved gaily from an old stern wheeler, getting up steam, already hung with hammocks, off to their mission, days and days away, up God knows what lost tributary. Side-wheelers, countless wobbling dugouts. A cow stood up in one, quite calm, chewing her cud while being ferried, tipping, wobbling somewhere to be married. A river schooner with raked masts and violet-coloured sails tacked in so close her bowsprit seemed to touch the church, cathedral, rather. A week or so before, there'd been a thunderstorm and the cathedral had been struck by lightning. One tower had a widening zigzag crack all the way down. It was a miracle. The priest's house right next door had been struck too, and his brass bed, the only one in town, galvanized black. Graças a Deus, he'd been in Belém. In the blue pharmacy, the pharmacist had hung an empty wasp's nest from a shelf. Small, exquisite, clean matte white, and hard as stucco. I admired it so much he gave it to me. Then my ship's whistle blew. I couldn't stay. Back on board, a fellow passenger, Mr. Swan, Dutch, the retiring head of Philips Electric, really a very nice old man, who wanted to see the Amazon before he died, asked, "What's that ugly thing?"
And then her great friendship with Robert Lowell, which had given them both so much pleasure almost weekly throughout her life, was damaged when he decided to recycle letters from his wife, Elizabeth Hardwick, in his poem, The Dolphin. Elizabeth Bishop felt that he was very unjust to Elizabeth Hardwick and he shouldn't have done this, and it undoubtedly dented their relationship. And then, in September 1977, Robert Lowell died. Elizabeth wrote of her loss in a poem dedicated to him.
North Haven. The islands haven't shifted since last summer, even if I like to pretend they have. Drifting in a dreamy sort of way, a little north, a little south, or sideways, and that they're free within the blue frontiers of bay. This month, our favourite one is full of flowers. Buttercups, red clover, purple vetch, hawkweed still burning, daisies pied, eyebright, the fragrant bedstraws, incandescent stars, and more returned to paint the meadows with delight. The goldfinches are back, or others like them, and the white-throated sparrow's five-note song, pleading and pleading, brings tears to the eyes. Nature repeats herself, or almost does. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Revise, revise, revise. Years ago, you told me it was here, in 1932, you first discovered girls, and learned to sail, and learned to kiss. You had such fun, you said, that classic summer. Fun, it always seemed to leave you at a loss. You left North Haven, anchored in its rock, afloat in mystic blue. And now, you've left for good. You can't derange or rearrange your poems again. But the sparrows can their song. The words won't change again. Sad friend, you cannot change.
She completed her teaching assignment at New York University, but she needed an income and accepted a new teaching job at Massachusetts Institute of Technology to start in September 1979. That summer, she and Alice took a swan's tour around Greece, visiting Delphi, Delos, Mykonos, Kos, Santorini. Back in the States, she had classes scheduled for September, but by now, she was too ill to keep them. Instead, she wrote out with her own hand in capital letters,
"Miss Bishop is in hospital and is very sorry she will be unable to meet her classes this week. She will meet them on October the 7th and 8th.
She died on October the 6th from a cerebral aneurysm.
The mountain. At evening, something behind me. I start for a second, I blench, or staggeringly halt and burn. I do not know my age. In the morning, it is different. An open book confronts me, too close to read in comfort. Tell me how old I am. And then the valleys stuff impenetrable mists like cotton in my ears. I do not know my age. I do not mean to complain. They say it is my fault. Nobody tells me anything. Tell me how old I am. The deepest demarcations can slowly spread and fade like any blue tattoo. I do not know my age. Shadows fall down, lights climb, clambering lights. Oh, children, you never stay long enough. Tell me how old I am. Stone wings have sifted here, with feather hardening feather. The claws are lost somewhere. I do not know my age. I am growing deaf. The bird calls dwindle. The waterfalls go unwiped. What is my age? Tell me how old I am. Let the moon go hang. The stars go fly their kites. I want to know my age. Tell me how old I am. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seemed filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, a disaster.